Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives, sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. My guest today is Daniela Mastanyuk-Young. She was a third-generation member of the family, a cult better known as the Children of God. From birth, she was raised to believe that the world outside was dangerous, it was full of evil people, and that childhood sex with multiple older men, known as uncles, was really quite normal. In fact, it was God's will. Well, when she was just 15 years old, Daniela had the fortitude to escape everything she knew. She put herself through school and forged a new career, only to find herself back in what she calls another cult. And today we discuss that. We share how to identify culture versus cult, the three phases to leaving a cult, and how finally telling her story has helped Daniela overcome imposter syndrome and build a healthy new life with her real family. So a little bit more about Daniela. After escaping the cult, the Children of God, she became an author and speaker and served as an intelligence officer for more than 6 years in the U.S. Army, achieving the rank of captain. Daniela was one of the first recognized women in the U.S. Army history to conduct deliberate ground combat operations on a female engagement team. Daniela is the recipient of the President's Volunteer Service Award and is currently finalizing her master's degree in industrial and organizational psychology from the Harvard Extension School. I have a feeling that degree is going to really be put to good use. Her new book is called Uncultured. It's a memoir, and here's my guest, Daniela Mastanyuk-Young. Daniela Mastanyuk-Young, welcome to the show. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
I'm so pleased to have you. I am fascinated by cult think, as I think many people are these days. And I've studied it quite a bit myself several years ago. And so as soon as I saw your book, it's like, of course, we have to talk with Daniela. We can dive straight in here because there's so much to talk about. You were born a third generation member of the infamous Children of God. It used to be, I think, Teens for Jesus, and then it changed to Children of God. And you traveled around with them for a while, lived with them until you were about 15, and now you're doing something entirely different. So, like I said, there's so much to talk about here. But I'm really curious about how you started to think about writing a book, because you'd never written before, you weren't a writer, but you had an incident when you were actually in the Army. So let's start with that and how the book came about.
Yeah, so I considered myself a reader, and I got an honors degree in literature when I finally got out of the cult, but I definitely didn't know that I would ever write a book. And I had started thinking about it, as I saw all these parallels to cult world, being in the military and programming and the things they put us through, and then of course these interesting parallels in kind of the rape culture that I experienced in the sex cult, and then again in the U.S. Army, which I was not expecting. And I had the idea that I could write this book and I could put the two together and I could make it about a book about group behavior, not just this crazy story that I've lived, but I didn't really know why. And then there was another woman soldier named Vanessa Guillen who went missing. The Army didn't really respond at all. And then eventually her body was found. And it was kind of a big Me Too movement for a lot of the women veterans to come out and say, this has happened to me, this has happened to all of us, the sexual harassment, the assault. And I just thought to myself, oh, someone needs to tell this story really big and sort of show America what happens to the daughters when we disappear behind these commune walls of the Department of Defense. And then I was like, oh, there's my parallel, that's my story. I have to be the one to do it.
Yes, and you do a great job of it, I have to say. You weave your journey with the cult and the military throughout the book. So let's dive into this cult. It's I think, probably one of the better known cults. I'd certainly heard of it. Tell us a little bit about what daily life was in there. You refer to it as a religious sex cult, and they twisted a lot of, as many religions do, twisted to suit their practice, right?
Yeah, you know, Children of God was started in the late 60s, which was the sort of era of cults, social confusion, people looking for gurus. And David Berg did exactly what you said. He took kind of your run-of-the-mill, very conservative evangelicalism, and then he twisted the sex piece. So instead of it being purity culture, it was kind of forced, share sex with everybody, God's love is shown through sex. This turned into religious prostitution, turned into sexual behaviors from adults to children, which of course is what makes it very scandalous. And I would say when I was growing up in the 80s and 90s, life was just a lot more about labor, which cults sort of ultimately always are about motivating people and getting their labor. And the Children of God got really into childhood entertainment videos, and they started producing those and selling millions and millions of them around the world. And so my childhood growing up was a lot of institutionalized living, standing in lines, kind of like you're in a religious prison camp. And then we would also act and sing and dance on these videos and then go sell them on the street. And definitely no schooling, no, you know, other contact with the outside world outside of our communes other than to bring in money.
Right, right. And adults, you were born into the cult, but adults coming into the cult gave up literally everything, all possessions, right, which they often do.
Yes, absolutely everything. And my grandfather, in my case, was the one who joined, and they give up all their possessions. They called it dropping out of the system. And any money they had, everything went over to the leadership.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, they also gave over their children sort of to the group.
When you were born, you were basically handed over to the commune nursery, and your mother had to have visiting hours to come see you.
Oh, yeah. And that was our whole lives, you know. And my mom was born and raised in the cult, and then she was one of the younger teenagers to then give birth to me at 15. And it was, you know, a month in bed recovering from the C-section, and then she's back off to her labor in the commune, which is as one of the prophet's secretaries, and I am in the nursery being nursed by her or maybe by some other mom who stops by for, you know, that hour.
Yeah. It's so hard to comprehend from outside. You know, you write about your mother's 12th birthday when the aunties, which the women were called, told her to make a list of all the uncles she wanted to have sex with. And I think of myself at 12, I think of my father's friends, and it's like gross to even think about that. Did that seem normal to you? I know you weren't there for your mother's 12th birthday, but I mean, did that just seem normal?
You know, to her it did seem normal because she was raised in this, the heart of the leadership. She was one of the older children, and so she was always just kind of waiting to be an adult, waiting to do the next thing. And we, all of us from birth, were groomed in this idea that your body is for the glorification of God. It's especially if you're a girl or a woman. So to my mom, you know, she'll tell me they had this distinction of like who the creepy uncles were and who the nice uncles were.
Right.
And the nice uncles were the ones you would put on your list to want to have sex with.
Right.
But, you know, my father ends up being actually older than my grandfather, and as it happens.
Right.
But just like you said, it was one of his friends.
Yes, yeah. The first rule of being in a cult, you say, is that it's not a cult. That's the thinking, because, you know, people can't identify they're in a cult, especially if you're born into it. I mean, I can see that, you know, we're born into families and we think our family's normal and everybody else is not, kind of thing, until we grow up a bit. But But you have a name that you called outsiders. It was, what was it, Systemites.
Yes. And that's, you know, very important in culting, is to have that us versus them, right? And you have to constantly have the outside and the persecution complex. And, you know, it was kind of funny to me once I finally realized it was a cult. I was like, oh, I should have known, because we spent so much time defending the fact that we weren't a cult. But as you said, you don't think about it that way when you're growing up in it.
Yeah, yeah. And you even reported on each other. I mean, it wasn't just us versus them. Within the culture itself, there was punishment, there were spanking lines, and you could maybe get a little less spanking if you reported on somebody else. So, I mean, it must have been a very fearful environment. You write about that, you know, it was fearful environment for you, really.
Yeah, it definitely was, you know, kind of this North Korean prison camp vibe almost. And it's really effective to use not only Jesus, who can see into your heart, but Jesus spoke directly to our prophets and to our leadership. So, you know, we were raised to kind of report on each other out of our own volition almost, because we would be so afraid that Jesus would see and Jesus would tell a grown-up that we had done something wrong.
Right, right. And so when you came to America, I mean, you'd been raised thinking America was evil, the government was evil, the people here were evil. And you say you get here and it's nothing like you pictured it would be. Tell us what it was like when you first arrived, why you arrived, how you arrived, and what your first thoughts were.
Yeah, so we came to America just briefly. We were supposed to be moving to a commune in Mexico, and we had to stop in the U.S. for a while. And it was the biggest culture shock of my life, because I had grown up being called an American and knowing that I had an American passport and speaking English, but never with any kind of even an idea of what being an American was, other than y'all were evil, America was Babylon the Whore, and it was going to be, you know, judged by God very soon. So then we get to America. My first thoughts are, it's so loud because everyone around me is speaking English, and that had never happened before. And I could read all the signs. And I think one of the most significant things about coming to America was the walls came down. So, you know, I was used to living on these compounds with big walls that you couldn't leave, no one could come in. That's pretty normal in Brazil to have that. In the U.S., you just have a five-bedroom house, and so we have to act a lot differently. We can't be on the street begging. We have to be, you know, doing school. So things really started to change. And then, of course, 9/11, or as my cult called it, the judgment of God, happened.
Right. And that was a big turning point for you, because you started to realize what?
Oh, yes. I call that the crack in the brainwashing for me. And that was, you know, the first time I have had live television, live news on in my life. And I'm watching these towers fall, and I'm watching people die, and I'm hearing the cults praise God, say this is the promised destruction. And I heard the term religious extremism on television, and I was 14 years old, and I just, you know, that was the moment that my cognitive dissonance couldn't get over. And I remember thinking very specifically, I wonder if we're the religious extremists.
Right. And did you talk with your parents about that? Did you talk with anybody about that?
No, not at all.
And so, but that led to a big change in your life, because that's when you basically were disassociated. So tell us what happened there.
Yeah, you know, I had always thought I would need to wait till I was 18 to leave the cult, and because all of my family was in it too. But the problem was, the year you turn 16, you become an adult, and you're going to be expected to have a lot of sex. You're not allowed to use birth control. And I knew from watching my mom have 7 babies in 14 years that, you know, this was my window of opportunity. And I'd had this realization, I wanted to leave. So I started acting out. I pretty much had a a really rebellious teenager campaign in order to get myself excommunicated. And then with that, you know, I was no longer invited to live in this place, which happened to be a commune in Mexico. And so my parents found me a place with a stepsister that I had, and I was, boom, dazed and confused in Houston, Texas.
Dazed and confused. I am mind blown, I would think. And
oh my goodness.
You know, once you start getting exposed, I mean, you go to school, you go to college, you start, you know, you're reading all these books, which certain people want to ban right now, and it opens up your mind, and you you see things totally differently. So, but you said always there was this feeling of imposter syndrome, and you fabricated a story because you were afraid to share your real self. So tell us what that experience was like, you know, living. I read in one part where somebody thought when you came out to him that you were escaping a mafia family when you talked about the family.
I say, like, my whole childhood growing up, I was not into the religion. I was not into the cult. Like, I wasn't having any of it. But you can't avoid all the programming of the world around you. And I think the one thing I really absorbed was this idea that the outside world is evil. You're never going to fit in. You know, this is what the aunties tell you over and over again. If you leave the family, you're going to be a drug addict, flipping burgers at McDonald's. You're never going to amount to anything. And so I was convinced, and many of us believe the cult were convinced, like, we don't belong here, so we have to not really lie, but, like, try to pass. You know, so you're trying to deal with your own history, but you're also trying to sort of be normal girl from Texas whose parents were missionaries, and you just don't talk much, you don't learn how to relate. And yes, so a decade later when I realized now I'm in the Army, I need to start talking about this because it's killing me. And one of my friends did tell me later that I was so bad at trying to tell this story, and I kept saying I left the family. He thought I was in the witness protection program from mafia.
Right. Well, yeah, when people are trying not to share the full story, the imagination of others runs riot, right?
And that's exactly what my experience was. It was when I was trying to hold myself back, I couldn't break into having friends and having, like, authentic relationships until I just started coming clean and sharing who I was.
Right. And so you know, you've escaped from this cult and then you join the Army, which, you know, has comparisons in that it's regimented and, you know, institutionalized. You thought you knew what you were getting into. What surprised you the most?
Yes, so, you know, in the Children of God, we called ourselves God's Army. We were very militaristic. We did battle drills preparing for the end of times. So I kind of knew, like, oh, I can hack being a soldier. Like, I can handle this. And even in my, you know, the prologue of Uncultured is me at basic training realizing I joined another cult. But I was confronting it kind of like, I know how to do this. I know how to be a group member in a high control group. And so all of that was expected. I think the really surprising thing for me was the culture of kind of just unabated sexual harassment and sexual violence towards women that was very triggering and very much paralleled for me the way it was for women and children in the sex cult, especially once I got to Afghanistan and sex was banned and women were 5% of the population. Everything just became so much more intense.
Right. And this was what year, just to put things in perspective here?
2011.
Was my first trip to Afghanistan. Yeah. And so there's this culture of don't talk about it, basically. Do you think that's improved? I mean, have you looked into that, if it's improved since then? Because, you know, we've heard a lot about it and we've heard a lot of lip service about it improving.
So, you know, just 2 weeks ago, another woman turned up who had been brutally assaulted by multiple people and then was unalive in suspicious circumstances, and the military is not cooperating. And every time you know, even Congress tries things like taking the prosecution of sexual assault and harassment out of the chain of command, the military fights those things. So I do think there has been some changes that should help, but the culture, and especially, as you mentioned, the culture of don't talk about it, and the culture of you women have to be here, so be proud of it, be proud of your service, but don't talk about all this trauma that you also experience. I think that is really what is keeping the military from being able to move forward and address some of these deeply rooted problems.
Right, right. You were deployed twice to Afghanistan. You were, I mean, you did very well in there. I want to point that out. You know, you were one of the, you were a member of one of the Army's first female engagement teams. Tell us what that experience was like. I know women fought before then, but this was the first really recognized team, right?
Yeah, and so what's interesting about this is absolutely women have been in ground combat in every conflict since the Revolutionary War, but the military didn't have to report it that way. There were these bans. Women technically weren't allowed to do certain things. So, you know, in 2003, if you were a female supply sergeant in Iraq, you were probably just as likely to get engaged by enemy as the infantry patrol was, but the military didn't have to call it deliberate. But in 2011, as part of counterinsurgency operations and win the hearts and minds, they realized, like, we have to put women on these teams to engage with the women and children. And so, you know, in Uncultured, you see, like, our first groups, we're going out there. We have no training. We have armor that doesn't fit our bodies to keep us alive. And we're going out with these exceptionally trained, like, tip-of-the-spear soldiers. And I think it was this big shift, where as soon as you call it these deliberate missions where they are going out with the purpose of engaging enemies, it's really hard for military commanders to still justify not giving us the training and the right equipment and all of those other things we need. So it was this really big turning point, I think, for the military, where we had always been saying, like, women need to be men or as good as the men in order to do combat. And we realized when we got onto these teams, it's like, well, men and women are trying to kill us. It makes a lot of sense to have both of these perspectives, and we bring so much to the fight as women. So right. We should start using that.
Right. And tell us why you came out of the Army.
Oof, boy, oh boy. You know, overall, I think it's called the glass cliff, where it just becomes too exhausting standing up every day in such a sexist organization. But I had a, you know, this is kind of the climax of the book, where even on the best team I'd ever been on in the Army, you know, the one toxic leader is still able to kind of just blow everything up and just really, you know, women in the Army are expected to try so hard and be twice as good and always be the bitch if you want to get respected. And I got caught in this, well, you know, now you're the bitch. Now you're the one creating a toxic environment for people. And it was such a just sort of crazy experience of toxic group behavior that I said, you know what? I think these parallels are too much for me, and I'm going to move on to my next thing.
Yeah, and sometimes you can fight from within, and sometimes the best place you can be to fight is outside the organization. I think your book certainly throws a lot of light on situations that I was not aware of. You know, I don't have anyone in my family who's ever been in the military, so it's very interesting to in this day and age to think that there are groups out there who still think of women really as second-class citizens. I mean, we see every day now, unfortunately, right?
Yes, we do absolutely see that. And that was a shocking thing for me when I joined, because I wasn't aware that, you know, women were still banned from doing all of these things. And I absolutely believe that those kinds of things fundamentally contribute to the culture at the end of the day. And as you said, one of my motives in writing this book was exactly this. The military loves their after-action reviews, talk about missions, how they went down, and what we can do better. And so I see this as my after-action review with the nation about, like, my experience being a sister in the Band of Brothers.
Yeah. One of the things you say is that you had to learn, when you're writing this book, you had to learn how to tell your story. You know, we have these stories and we don't always know how to tell them, how to share them. And you say that actually writing this, reliving it, was actually worse than going through your whole life experience. So share a little of that, if you would.
Writing this and doing the audio recording were probably two of the harder things I've done. It turned into, I think, a really beautiful process where I had no idea how to write a book by myself. And so I found a co-writer who was an experienced writer. I ended up with a team of me and two women writing this book. And it was beautiful in a way that, of course, to survive my life, I used a lot of disassociation tactics from my earliest years. And readers point out that I'm very good at describing disassociation. I was very not good at sort of reliving the emotions or even connecting the right emotions to the right events. And so working with other women, I think, turned into this experience of how we heal from trauma, which is we tell our stories to our friends, they tell them back to us in other words, or they give us like a similar thing they've been through. And I was able to go from, you know, nobody can understand my stories because they're so rare and unique, to, you know, I think any woman in the world can pick up this book and really relate to it at several different places.
Yes. And the beautiful thing is that you say now you've told your story, that story can't be used to hurt you anymore. So I think that's, you know, a great thing there. Are you still at college? Are you still doing organizational psychology, right?
I've got one class left.
I figured you'd be pretty close to the end on that. But one of the things you say is that you see traces of Children of God with all its inherent cult think and harmful behavior in almost every group, organization, or team you've ever joined or studied. And I often think this myself when I work with certain groups. This is like a cult. I feel like an outsider here. But you say you're always asking, what is the difference between a culture and a cult? And you say you don't think there is a great deal of difference. So elaborate on that.
Yes, so I think that sometimes we don't consider cults as groups. Like, if you want to study groups, you go into organizational psychology. If you want to study societal problems, you go into sociology. And we miss the fact that cults are just kind of the most extreme groups, and they actually do certain things like motivation tactics, like community building, things that, you know, regular organizations are trying to do. Cults do them very well. And so I think it's important to look at sort of all groups on a scale of cultishness, maybe, and see where the triggers are for toxic behavior. And two of the things I think people can look at very easily is, one, how much of your time does this group take, just in general, but also versus what you're getting from it. But if it's taking too much of your time, literally anything can become a cult, because now they've got you isolated. And then the second thing is, what are the exit costs? And those aren't always just money. They can be friends, losing community. It can be social embarrassment from having to say you were wrong. So those are the two things I think are quick and easy to look at if you feel like your group, your organization, may be getting a little cultish or toxic.
Right. Good information there. And you say there are three phases to leaving a cult. The first is the crack in the brainwashing, which happened for you with 9/11 when you started being exposed to, you know, a bigger world out there and the messaging around it. The second is understanding why you joined a cult and how that impacts your identity. And of course, you were born into it. And then the third is that you have to learn to go forward. And this, I think, must be the hardest thing, because this is all you've ever known. Your whole identity is wrapped up in it. most people that I've talked with who've come out of cults, you know, their friends, their family, their distant relatives, I mean, everybody's in that cult. And when they come out, there's nothing. And so rebuilding that life can be very difficult. How did you cope with, I mean, did you have any doubts even when you were out about going back?
So I never had any doubts. I will definitely say that, you know, psychologists say leaving high control groups is the closest to death that we know of.
Right.
And I will definitely say that feeling was incredibly hard. I was incredibly lonely for the 6 years before I went back in the Army, which I'm sure was a big part of it. But, you know, I also sometimes say that losing everything I knew at 15 was maybe one of the best things that happened to me, because I think, like, we're all going through this right now, right? We're all realizing, like, the systems that we believed in, the values that we thought, mm-hmm. whether our country, organizations, or families held, are maybe toxic. And the way you get through this is by just not taking anything for granted. So every time you're going to do anything and you ask yourself, like, where did I get that from? You know, where did I get that idea from? And then so often for me, you know, I find out that I don't think this way. Like, I was programmed into thinking this way. And so even though I don't think that anymore, I still need to take out that idea and almost clean it off. And so, you know, I do think this is the hard part, is going forward without any models. And I think that in some ways, all millennials are dealing with this right now.
Yeah, it, you know, and having lived in more than two countries, I've lived in like three or four countries, you recognize behavior in other countries that you don't recognize in your own until you've lived away for a while. And then you go back to your own country and you think, whoa, this is questionable, you know. So it happens worldwide. One of the best exposures is to get out into other cultures and see how other people handle things. And I think it's a great education. And of course, we haven't been able to travel the last couple of years, so that's not helped, right?
And, you know, there's research about this, and it definitely ties into cult thinking, which is isolation. And so there's very interesting research that people who grow up without traveling describe the first time that they travel as life-changing. Hmm. And every time after that, it's just a cool experience. And, you know, psychologists think that that life-changing time is because you see another culture that's so different from yours, but that is perfectly valid. And I really think that is absolutely the power to getting outside of your own perspective.
Right, right. I'm reading a line here from some material I got with your book. It says, I'm calling what we're going through right now the culting of America because of the polarization and the isolation you just mentioned, and the us versus them attitudes are changing everything about the fabric of our nation before our eyes. And it's so true. And it's my brother keeps telling me we're living in interesting times, and I keep telling him, yeah, I think I could do without them, quite frankly.
So you're exactly right, and I may be working on a book called The Culting of America. And, you know, this is when we see cults pop up, is during times of social confusion, during times when there's so many things going on, we're pulling down systems, and people like gravitate towards gurus and easy ways of understanding things. And, you know, one of the very different things that's going on now is that, you know, cults rely on isolation. And in my grandfather's day, to get an American isolated, you had to take them to your commune. Mm-hmm. Everyone else was watching the same TV, listening to the same radio. These days with AI, when you can vote on what kind of commercial you want to listen to, you can be isolated in a toxic thought system in your own home. So, like, the cults of today, as we've seen, are so different than anything we've seen before.
Right. Well, the book is really worth reading. It's called Uncultured. My guest, Daniela Mastanyuk-Young. And I know listeners can find out much more about you at your website, which is uncultureyourself.com, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, uncultureyourself.com. A final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with, Daniela?
of this book is that most of you haven't probably compared a sex cult to the U.S. Army before. And it's not that it's exactly the same, but it's that when you see these striking parallels, you'll start to question all your groups. And I hope that all the readers will just walk into the next group meeting they're in and just ask themselves, is this a cult? And if you don't laugh, that's your first sign.
Oh my gosh, I'm in a cult. Okay. Well, I make that reference because I'm with a group periodically as a consultant, not very often, fortunately. Nobody ever laughs there. All right, we're right at the end
of
our...
We all have little cults in our lives.
We do. Yeah. Well, it's been fascinating talking with you. The book is really great reading, and I thank you for sharing your experiences with us and wish you all the best on your journey and look forward to your next book.
Thank you. Me too. Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. If you have questions, comments, or feedback regarding today's podcast, you can reach me on our website at conversationslive.net. Thanks for joining us today. We'll have a new podcast go live next Wednesday. Until then, live well, live strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.